your weekly fix on finance and investing. This is the Cortland Economics Report.
All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. I hope everybody enjoyed those first two segments with Jesse Felder. In these final two segments of the show, we are chatting with Rick Bensignor, president of Bensignor Investment Strategies, writes the institutional newsletter, Supposedly Irrelevant Factors, that is read by some of the most successful hedge funds in the world. And on the retail side, he writes the In the Know Trader, and a piece called 7-Eleven, where Rick chooses no more than 7 of the 11 spider ETFs with the goal to beat the S&P. Rick, I want to talk big picture with you regarding central banks, not just the Fed, but central banks around the world are generally going through a tightening process. They are more hawkish than they have been in a number of years. And the Fed, hey, they hiked rates this week and are forecasting more rate hikes. You listen to what Bullard had to say after the rate hikes, and he wants a 3% Fed funds rate by the end of the year. That seems a bit aggressive. This whole concept, though, of central banks tightening, when we look to the U.S. equity markets, how can anybody project a more bullish market or higher prices when we're not having all that free money that, well, was the narrative of driving these markets higher? That's off the board now. So where would that money come from?
Well, the money can come from other asset classes, even notably bonds. If rates are going to, well, here, I'm going to make the assumption that the 40-year bull market in bonds is over, that the low we saw a couple of years ago is the low, down at, I think, 39 bips or something like that in the U.S. 10-year. And that 40-year bull that started essentially 1980, 1981 is over. So we can go sideways for a while, which won't really generate a lot of money coming out of the bond market, or rates will make their way higher over time, which is what I think likely happens. And therefore, by the very fact that rates go higher, it means bond prices go lower. So you have people selling bonds, and they have to decide what to do with that money. And some of it will come to the stock market, and therefore it does create some potential additional buying power for the stock market. It won't offset the fact that the Fed is no longer supportive of putting essentially free money into the system, which has propped up the market since the financial crisis of 2007 through 2009. So you've lost probably the biggest determinant of what has pushed prices higher over time. But it doesn't mean we have to go into a bear market or a prolonged bear market in the stock market. And higher rates aren't necessarily bad for the stock market. I've said before, I think the 10-year could probably get to 3%, even 3.5% before it really makes a huge dent into the buyers of the stock market, where if once you start getting 3.5% or more guaranteed, I think you take some people out of the stock market, especially after the years of run it's had on the upside, and essentially you're presenting an alternative investment that has no risk as far as you collecting your coupon and getting your money back at the end. So I'm going to again assume that the U.S. will never default on its treasuries. So there are ways to cushion the fact that you no longer have an accommodative Fed. That being said, that was the single biggest ingredient to why the market has moved up as much as it has in the last 14 years or 13 years or so, I guess, since the March 09 bottom. And it, to me, it diminishes over time how much you would expect out of the stock market on an annual basis.
Well, those are some salient points, Rick, because that was the juice that gave the markets the big impetus to pull off one of the largest and longest bull markets in recent memory. And so with that accommodative buying coming out and with that liquidity coming out, of course, we can't expect the same kind of returns we've seen for the last dozen or so years. You made an interesting point there in the bond market, though, that you know a lot of people have mentioned that it's possible that 40-year bond bubble has burst. And as we see rates come up, there is that question of what role will treasuries have if the Fed does get their Fed funds rate to 2%, then a 3.5% a 10-year wouldn't be that unusual. I guess the question I would have is, do you really think that in an environment where inflation is 5, 6, 7, even 7.9% on the last reading, there would still be a negative real rate or a negative real return, even at 3% or 3.5%. So is there going to be a migration out of bonds and into the other asset classes like the stock market, gold, cryptos, what have you? And is the whole model that the financial industry uses about having such a huge weighting to bonds, the historic 60-40, 60% equities, 40% bonds model, does that need to be turned upside down on its head and reexamined?
Well, I think the latter is correct in the sense that it should be reexamined. I don't know if I'd turn it upside down on its head, but if you're going into a potential lengthy bear market in bonds, then I'm not sure I want to be putting in anything close to 40% of a portfolio into the bond market. I don't like the idea of almost essentially having guaranteed losses, which you will have if you buy bonds and the price of bonds goes lower. So yes, you collect your coupon payment, but you're going to lose on the actual bonds. So I think it really, the answer to that, Chad, has a lot to do with what your age is. If you're 70 years old, then you probably want to have at least 50%, if not more than that, in the bond market, because once you're past the point of earning active income from employment, and the your income really comes from fixed income and other investments, you want to kind of know it's there to last you the rest of your life. If I was 30 years old, there's no way I'd want a 60-40 split. I'd much want to be, I think if you're 30 years old, you probably want 80-20 or potentially even 90-10, because you've got a 40, at least minimally a 40-year time horizon in a retirement account before you're going to touch that money. And you want to be essentially in the most aggressive places you can be. And I don't mean speculative in the case of Bitcoin or something like that, but I'd much rather be, you know, if I'm a young adult and starting off life as an adult and maybe just newly married and starting a family, and I'm kind of in that 30 to 40 year age group, let's even put it 25 to 40, I want to be putting the bulk of my retirement, anything I'm putting away into a company 401k plan, or if you're self-employed into your own SEP IRA, I want to be in stocks and I don't really want to be in bonds. So I'd probably be at least 80-20, because that's your best chance for real growth over the next 40 years. And, you know, pick another investment over that type time horizon that does better than stocks, and you're not going to find one. So you disregard the, you know, 3-month decline that we've had now and to scare you off. And, you know, I tell my kids, I have a 31-year-old daughter and a 28-year-old daughter and a 23-year-old son. So two of them are working and the youngest one's in grad school. Two who are working, I tell them, put their money into S&P 500 funds and aggressive type funds, because you'll be glad you did when you look at it on a 40-year time horizon. And that's what they're looking at. Assuming there's still some type of deferred compensation plans that the government lets you take advantage of, and you're not going to pay tax on that money until you're 70, and by the time they hit 70, that number could be 75 or 80, who knows, when you'd have to start taking out the money. These are long-term, multi-decade investments. You want to be in stocks. You don't want to be in bonds. Not when your time horizon is that long.
So, Rick, I guess that brings us to, what stocks do you want to be into right now? Because what led the market for the last maybe even decade was the tech sector, this high-flying tech sector. Everyone was okay with companies not making any sort of profit. They just wanted to see, I guess, more money being raised and more users or whatever metric they were judging into that company. What sectors do you like now? Because tech has been under a lot of pressure.
Well, yes. So the tech sector, Corey, obviously got its valuations essentially rewritten. And the marketplace investors were no longer willing to take the high multiples the way they were when the Fed was accommodative. Now that we know for sure they're not going to be accommodative. So a huge compression on multiples. I think you still have to be in tech, but what I'm going to do and what I'll be telling my clients to do is to use the rally in tech to lighten the amount of exposure they have in that sector relative to their overall exposure. So I certainly want to be in tech and I want to be slightly overweight, but I don't want to be heavily overweight. So if tech makes up, I don't know, 28%, give or take, of the S&P, to me, it's fine being, 32%. You don't want to be 35% or something like that or more in tech. It certainly has hurt you for the last couple months, and we will bounce somewhat from here, but I would use that to essentially take down the amount of overweight. But to me, if you're running a diversified portfolio, you have to be in tech because it, and your benchmark to the S&P, you have to have it because it's the biggest weight by far. Where I'm strongly overweight and have been since August of last summer is energy. And that's a place that I think not only has it been a disaster to be invested in energy relative to any other sector of the 11 macro sectors of the market for the last 20 years. And there are periods that there are a couple years along the way it did outperform. But if you look at, let's use XLE, the S&P Spider Energy ETF. XLE has underperformed not just the market over 20 years, but you actually have, you're down money if you invested in energy starting in the year 2000. And there's no other sector of the market. Think about it. 20 years, this market has had explosive growth in price, the S&P, and you're actually down money in the energy sector. I think, and I made this call months ago, that underperformance is done for quite some time, such that there'll be dramatic capital expenditures into the area going forward. To me, the energy sector, I'm not saying it takes the place of technology. It won't, certainly in weightings. Energy is 3.5% of the S&P. Tech is, like I said, about 28%. So I'm not looking for them to overlap that way. But it's very possible that if you look over the next 5 years, energy could potentially outperform technology. So it's a place I want to be heavily invested in and overweight for years to come. So that's another place. Obviously, financials is a segment to the market you want to be in and overweight, considering that if interest rates go higher, that's how banks and money institutions make their money. They borrow short term, they lend long term, and they make the spread in between. And it's a very profitable business. So financials are a place that I want to be. I think generally industrials are fine. The consumer on the discretionary side will get a bounce on this big bounce. And they've been the worst performer of the year. So that should correct some of itself and you get a little more return to equilibrium pricing. But I'm not sure I want to be hugely overweight like XLY going forward. So I'll use, I think, a bounce in that too to probably reduce some of the exposure we have there. But those are sectors I'm kind of looking at. I'm not a fan of staples. I'm not a fan of utilities, even though utilities have done well. I think it's a short-term thing. REITs, the classic defensive sectors I'm not in. I am overweight healthcare. I went overweight, I think it was either December 1st or January 1st. So, and that's been doing fine too. So that has outperformed since we turned overweight in it in that 7-Eleven report that you referenced in my introduction. Just to give you a sense also, that report that I write through our In the Know Trader platform, and that's for individual investors, not institutional, it's for individual investors and financial consultants, FAs, financial advisors. In the month of February, we outperformed the S&P by 22 basis points for our fiscal year, which happens to rotate on an August 1st calendar each year. So since August of last summer, we're outperforming the S&P by 2.22%. And since we started this in summer of 2020, so that's 19 months ago, we have outperformed the S&P by 5.67% in 19 months. So being able to use a combination of technicals and quant modeling, we can generally figure out which sectors you want to be in and overweight, and which sectors you don't want in your portfolio. And so out of the 11, we max out at 7. We do no less than 5 and no more than 7 to have in. We change our allocation once a month at the beginning of the month. So the report comes out the last day of the the month that's ending, to give you the allocations for the next month. And we are essentially, with those type statistics, we are in the top 10% of all active money managers out there. And this is simply telling you how to invest your own money using the 11 SPDR ETFs.
Well, Rick, that's why we really value getting your comments here at the KE Report and highlighting which sectors you think are going to be outperformers, such as the healthcare, the consumer discretionary, energy that you brought up. I guess I want to circle back to the energy sector just because commodities have had such a huge run, and a lot of people watched that big move up in oil. Obviously, some of that was because of geopolitical tensions, and it's come off a little bit, but it's still a very strong price. But you outlined the point that in the energy sector, 20 years of underperformance, that it may be set up to take on more of a leadership role. So for all those people that are invested in oil and gas stocks or oil services stocks, and they're worried that maybe things are topping out, what would your medium to longer term outlook be for the energy sector?
My medium to longer term outlook is definitely positive. Shorter term, I even sold some energy names this week for myself, because I'll give you an example. I've been long Chevron since 75. I didn't mind taking some off at 164. It's a long-term capital gain. Sure, I got to pay taxes on it. I'll find some loser that I have in there, which I definitely have to offset, so I don't have to, you know, pay taxes, hopefully. But given I had a more than double on Chevron in less than 2 years, seeing what I saw and the technicals and where kind of the names are in energy even versus the market is, I didn't mind at all taking some off. But if XLE starts to underperform the S&P by anything meaningful, I'm going to come back in and buy more. So it's kind of a tactical move within a longer strategic play.
Rick, how do you view the rest of the commodity complex, like base metals? Because those have been on a run. Even copper, it has pulled back from all-time highs, but the general commodity sector has gone on a run. Obviously, that has been helped by the major move in energy, but base metals, how do you view these in terms of balancing out, again, a tightening monetary policy, but more, I guess, countries, more governments looking to spend money in commodities, in infrastructure buildouts?
Well, I think that's the key, is it's the infrastructure buildout that's not only being negotiated here in the U.S., but other parts of the world too. Now, typically, China is your largest buyer of those type metals, and you often can get a sense when you look at the price of copper of what's going on in the Chinese economy. But, you know, things are a little goofy these days simply because China has pre-built multiple cities with huge sky-rise apartments and stuff that are completely empty. They are planning for the future, and they have done a tremendous infrastructure build over the last 10, 20 years that so far hasn't even been put to use. So their demand right now has eased, yet other places in the world have kind of picked up some of that slack. Also in the commodities market, and this is a market that I grew up in. I was a trader in the commodity pits for 12 years in New York before I ever got to Morgan Stanley, and became a strategist there. So I'm deeply knowledgeable about commodity markets. I trade them every day. I trade for a fund too, where I'm one of the portfolio managers that globally trade commodities for them. So this is a market I know well. And there are times that things happen in the commodity markets that are very specific to the fact that these are structured contracts that have expiration dates, and people get caught in the wrong direction. And so you saw that in nickel. You've seen the price of wheat dramatically rise. It's more than double of what it was, I think, since last summer, because Russia is a strong exporter of wheat. And with what's going on, there's less demand for their wheat. So U.S. wheat prices and Canadian prices have moved up dramatically. There are times that events occur that take place inside these markets that can really bring extreme prices into play. And if you're on the wrong side of those, they can be very painful. If you're short a commodity that goes limit up day after day, you can't get out. And eventually when you can, it's probably only because it's the peak. And we saw that even recently, let's say in wheat, which was up several days in a row, limit bid. And then finally, when it was able to trade, it sold off sharply. There are great stories from this industry. One of the guys he used to trade with on the floor, and it was funny, it was an Orthodox Jew. And we were in the pit, and he stood right near me, and he wore a yarmulke, and you knew he was, you know, a religious Jewish person. But he once told me that he was short pork bellies, and he got stuck short in 13 days in a row. It closed limit bid. And finally, he got out, and then it sold off 13 days in a row, limit down. And, you know, it's just there are just some incredible stories that come from the market. So the commodity markets can do some very funky things over the short term. I'm a bull in commodities. I think that the low made in 2020 in the, let's say, the Goldman Sachs Commodity Index, and the individuals can easily play the commodity markets as an ETF through something as simple as the GSG is the ticker symbol. That's the Goldman Sachs Commodity Index. So that bottomed in at the COVID low in 2020. It's been on a rip since. We actually reached some targets last week and took some off. But in general, I will be buying a pullback when I get to, you know, prices that I'm comfortable with to buy more. And I think that, you know, typically a big rally like this in commodities tends to be a late cycle type thing. So this still could have more to go. But eventually, and with inflation, you can see the price of commodities has made a dramatic move higher. But there'll be a correction, and then one need to figure out if that was the end of the cycle or just, you know, a minor correction and what still has more to go. My guess is there's probably still more to go, but I'm not buying right up here in commodities as a whole. But I do think that the, let's call it, 2-year cyclical / secular bull market is still doing okay. And it's just, but it's not in a place I want to be a buyer right now.
Well, some interesting comments there on the commodities, Rick. And a lot of people have mentioned that if you look historically at other asset classes, whether it's the general stock markets or bonds or real estate, the commodities are still greatly undervalued. And so that this corrective move that may come in may just be a pullback in a larger uptrend that's still to play out. But one that we need to talk about that's really more of a monetary metal than just a commodity is gold. It did have a nice move up. It was already moving up since the end of last year, but it had a particularly larger spike once the Ukraine geopolitical tensions got roiled up. It has given up some, but we just had the Fed start their rate hiking cycle, the first hike of many. They project 7 different hikes coming up for the rest of this year. And the inflationary picture, which is also behind the commodity picture, is also a force that, you know, gets some traction in the gold markets. What do you make of the price action of gold? Where do you see it at now? Do you think that this rate hiking cycle will be bullish for the metal or bearish? What's your outlook on gold?
So rate hikes generally are not helpful to gold because you get no dividend with gold. The only way you make money owning it is if somebody pays more than you and you sell it out at a higher price. And so generally, as interest rates go higher, people look at a guaranteed yield as being a potentially a better, safer return than just purely speculating on which way the price of gold is going. I bought some gold in the fund on Wednesday, right after the Fed's announcement. I kicked half out yesterday, right near the high, and I'm kind of debating what to do with the rest just for short-term play. The interesting thing is gold got above 2050, I guess about, what, a week and a half ago, the day when it made its high, it crossed over 2050. So it got within $10 of its all-time high from August 2020. And, right away it pulled back over $100 and probably about, $160, $170 or something. It pulled back into Wednesday's low. And the question is, you know, is that all it's going to go or not? Right now, it looks like it is. But at the same time, I still like the longer term fundamentals for gold because of the debasement of the dollar and whether or not, you know, any other currency. I don't think I had this debate earlier this week with somebody who was telling me that because the Chinese are potentially trying to price oil deals in the yuan and not the dollar, that, you know, the once that happens, the U.S. dollar will no longer be the reserve currency for the global economy. I don't see the dollar being replaced by any currency at this point still, because as goofy as sometimes things get here in the U.S., there's no other country I'd rather have as the base currency, given the politics, given everything, than the U.S. It's still the most, you know, democratic of places. And to me, I don't think the world's ready to go change it over politics. So with that being the case, I think that the fundamentals for gold are good long term, but you have to deal with the short term swings and the things that you, if you own gold, I guess as I'm talking about this, the more what my brain says to me is the following. You own gold as a hedge. You own gold as a small piece of your portfolio against disaster, against, you know, things going wrong. And you can have some of it as a pure speculative play, no different than if you were buying IBM or a FANG name or whatever. You're not going to make the money the same way, and it certainly isn't going to be as fast. But you can have a small piece in as a speculative side, and then maybe the classic 3 to 5% as a hedge. But beyond that, I don't own gold. It is just that smaller piece of my overall portfolio. I play with it in the fund. But as far as owning it, you know, yes, I own gold. I have for, I don't know, 25 years or something like that. It's just, and I've done, I guess if you think about it over time, it's done well in price, but I'm not sure it's so much farther ahead of inflation over time. But, you know, short term, this move that we saw a week and a half, 2 weeks ago, back up over 2050 and testing the all-time highs and the immediate rejection of that, makes me think that, you know, near term, you could still potentially even, you know, right now we're trading about 1932 in front month COMEX gold as we record this midday on Friday. And yeah, could we fall down another $80, $100? Yes. Do I think we'd go much lower than that? I don't. And therefore, that's why I still keep a bias here. And maybe gold's time wasn't quite yet on the rally from 2 weeks ago. But I'm still a kind of a long-term fan of gold.
All right, Rick, we're wrapping up the weekend show, but I really appreciate you spending all this time with us. And hey, congratulations on that record against the S&P. I know throughout the years that we've been chatting, you have been calling the trends correctly, and even some of your short-term trading techniques have panned out nicely for you. So we always appreciate you taking time to share your thoughts with us. Again, Rick is president of Ben Senior Investment Strategies. Everybody, thank you for taking time on your weekend to listen to our show. Please keep in touch with Shad and I through email, fleck@kereport.com or shad@kereport.com. We hope you all have a great rest of your weekend.
To find out more about today's guests, visit us on the web at www.kereport.com. You're listening to the Corlin Economics Report. We'll be back in a moment.